This is Pharaoh's House.
We begin this Podiso lecture with part two of What Organism Are You? I recommend that you type or write down key points from this lecture segment. Ready? We begin. You are unique in that you are a continuation of your ancestral blood lineage. The deeds, debts, investments, affiliations, indirect connections, secrets, and contracts of your direct ancestors run the gamut qualitatively from beneficent and kind to indifferent, greedy, careless, and wicked. Whatever the paths those before you took, all paths lead to you and your siblings, if any, then to your offspring, and so on. Their legacy is now yours. Today you are the recipient of yesterday. Bloodline progression is the mechanism for true evolution or de-evolution, depending on the paths your ancestors took and the one you are on right now. The fact that you are listening to these words is no accident, no coincidence. It says you know today is the proving ground set in front of all of us, and we must decide whether to de-evolve into parasitism or do deeds which undo and or reverse these legacies. Future changes are within our grasp, but without honest review of remnant past, plus real forward thinking and action, that future will be destined for destruction and repetition. Many of you listening possess a legacy that includes mass migration to already inhabited lands. Life forms or organisms can migrate to new locales according to two natural law status modes. One, as mutually beneficial organisms, or two, as selfishly encroaching parasites. Keep these two status modes in mind. When a person or a people migrates to a new land, new to that person or people, they bring with them their individual legacies, and more importantly, their shared group legacy. The land itself goes through its own generational recycling or renewal. Remember, all land, unless completely desolate or lifeless, holds and supports countless endemic life forms, most importantly, people. Endemic means belonging energetically, biochemically, and ergonomically to or native to a particular people or place. When one group moves to or is transported to an inhabited land, they do so in one of the two status modes mentioned earlier. If the new group, or as Carolus Linnaeus might have said, species, enters as mutually beneficial organism, a sort of blending and assimilation happens within 4 to 8 generations. That's approximately 100 to 200 years. The blending occurs in the following manner. First, coexisting. Second, mutual reliance. Third, cultural interchange. Fourth, partial assimilation. Some sages say the fourth stage is where blending should always stop. They say that the fifth stage marks the end of mutuality, leading to adversarial competition over resources and infra-parasitism. Infra and intra mean within, like infrastructure or intranet. One group will either overwhelm the other, or they will both fall prey to external parasitic invaders, a house divided. Usually, the new arrivals will form alliances with parasitic invaders out of desperation or opportunism in order to gain an advantage or aim to defeat the aboriginal people of the land. Encroachment by an alien life form into the land of an aboriginal life form alters the generational life of the land itself and all sentient life upon it and within it. Encroachment is but one name for this act. Acclimatization and terraforming are two other euphemistic words for the act of encroachment. Generation recycling or renewal is indicated by particular markers, such as celestial bodies or trees. Certain trees like cedars are time markers of the generation intervals of land. Every 400 to 480 years, land goes through a major recycling or renewal, as do the people upon it, especially any remnant aboriginal groups or so-called tribes. People also go through a recycling or renewal in groups and as individuals, again based on timed intervals set in bloodline and astrological markers. To listen to the rest of this lecture, go become a paying subscriber to pharaohshouse.com. For just $2.25 a month, you'll not only have access to my podisodes, but also podisode archives and a growing knowledge base of unique PDF books, guides, pamphlets, and abstracts covering a wide variety of subjects. For subscribers, continue listening without interruption just by going to pharaohshouse.com and clicking on Community Library Current Podisodes if you're not there already. We go from the question, what organism are you, to the question, what color are you? This segment addresses race theory, challenges it, debunks it, and puts it to rest once and for all. What color are you? Before you answer, prepare to record or write notes. Warning, contents of this segment might offend some listeners. Therefore, lock your emotions in a closet until the lecture is through. Okay, what did you answer? Did you have to look at your skin before answering? Did you answer instantly? All right, next question. Do you have a color? Did you answer yes or no? Okay, I want you to remember those answers. Here's a caveat. Capitis diminutio, or diminishing of status through use of capitalization, curtailment or loss of a man's status through all black capital letters. This caveat refers to civil law or civil rights, which is the law of edux or edom or edumia, aka Rome or Roman law, as opposed to law of originator, creator, and natural law, not law of nature. There is a difference. Did you answer yes to do you have a color? Okay, the following is a layman's definition of color, quoted from a dictionary. Color is the appearance or semblance of a thing as distinguished from the thing itself. A legal description of color is a prima facie or fascia or apparent right, hence a deceptive appearance, a plausible assumed exterior, concealing a lack of reality, a disguise or pretext. Unquote. Race is a deliberately deceptive word, used to deter you from blood lineage facts. Race is often used synonymously with color, especially the two duality mechanisms of black and white. Nearly 10 years earlier, I actually lectured on this same subject. Well, here I am again, only this time I'm providing closure. Black is a status that refers to one or more of the following in jurisprudence, or so-called law, and in legal codes such as Uniform Commercial Code. Here are the legal synonyms for black. Non-void, as in absent from current or past situation, as in blacked out. Unaccepted, not visible. Non-existent, illegal, as in banned, unlawful, corrupt, by default, as in blacklisted or blackmail. Impure, as in uncleaned, blemished, marked, clandestine, or hidden, as in black market or black ops. Black is the absence of color, even though it is called a color, as in people of color. It absorbs all colors. In a social sense, anyone who is declared black or who declares themselves as black is by default accepting a contract of subservience in any society. A so-called black person cannot claim special, unique rights, unless any other group or so-called race is included in those rights. Why? Because remember, black absorbs all colors. Black history or black people or any other noun with the adjective black in front of it typically implicitly implies or means non-existent or false. Therefore, black history is non-existent, as are black people. Therefore, Black Lives Matter means any person using the phrase Black Lives Matter in reference to themselves is actually saying they do not matter. Obviously, anyone calling themselves black does exist physically, but socially, legally, and economically, they are saying that they are irrelevant or non-void or voided out. A person claiming black color status is claiming they own no rights which anyone is bound to respect. That is straight out of a Dred Scott court case decision, but it goes before that case. It goes back at least 1,000 years, or what we have been tricked into believing was 550 to 580 years ago in the so-called 1500s, when various popes, like Pope Nicholas, issued edicts and papal bulls declaring all aboriginals blackened out of existence. There was only two ways to achieve this. Remove them from their lands by force and extermination, in addition to alter them spiritually through religious dogma, persecution, and forced labor. These edicts and papal bulls have yet to be reversed and expunged by current pope, because these are the formulas that maintain an empire of control over aboriginal lands and resources.
So
Do you recall witnessing one of many news reports in the past warning audiences about overusing antibiotics? Those reports often mention that antibiotics breed resistant bacteria. Basically, over time, a particular antibiotic would become useless against a more resistant evolved bacterial strain. This is called antibiotic resistance. Did you know that vaccines do the same thing? It's called vaccine resistance. It's not given much attention or spoken about, especially during vaccine marketing campaigns like the current ongoing campaign. My question assumption is, do vaccines push pathogens to evolve? Do you agree that they do or disagree? One thing I have gleaned from my reading many abstracts and research studies on a variety of vaccines is that with vaccines, as opposed to drugs, pathogens evolve much faster and with more frequency. Vaccines can incite several strains over time. I have yet to witness this admitted to by primetime researchers, let alone primetime media. Want an example of my research findings? Okay, check this out. Pennsylvania State University for Infectious Disease Dynamics teamed up with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, or USDA, to study Marek's disease in poultry and how the virus might be evolving in response to its latest vaccine. Marek's is caused by a highly contagious, paralyzing, and ultimately deadly herpes virus. It is an ailment that costs the chicken industry more than $2 billion a year. Uninfected chickens get infected by inhaling contagions shed by infected chickens through dust particles. The first vaccine was introduced in 1970 when the disease was killing entire flocks. It worked well, but within a decade, the vaccine began to fail. Another vaccine, licensed in 1983, gradually failed too. A third vaccine is in use today, but will it fail like its antecedent vaccines? Who knows? But I remember I said that these pathogens evolve. When they evolve, they obviously don't become weaker, they become more deadly. And that's what happened in the case of the pathogen that causes Marek's disease, which was allegedly first detected over 100 years ago. Let's use a little logic here. The USDA admits that Marek's has been a known ailment problem in chickens for supposedly at least 100 years. It has been studied for at least half that time, presumably. We do know that an initial vaccine was developed and used for the first time in 1970. That's about 50 years ago. In that half a century of time, allegedly the virus has morphed at least three times into a more deadly or virulent strains. So can we conclude that it was the vaccines that incited the virus evolution? I think we can safely say yes. Here's a direct excerpt from a study published in a peer-reviewed journal. Please take note. Quote, in a 2015 paper in PLOS Biology, Reed and his colleagues vaccinated 100 chickens, leaving 100 others unvaccinated. They then infected all the birds with strains of Marek's that varied in how virulent, as in how dangerous and infectious they were. The team found that over the course of their lives, the unvaccinated birds shed far more of the least virulent strains into the environment, whereas the vaccinated birds shed far more of the most virulent strains. The findings suggest that the Marek's vaccine encourages more dangerous viruses to proliferate. This increased virulence might then give the viruses the means to overcome birds' vaccine-primed immune responses and sicken vaccinated flocks. End of excerpt. Penn State University-based scientist Andrew Reed even admitted that immunization is also making once rare or non-existent genetic variants of pathogens more prevalent. And vaccines being developed against some of the world's most volatile pathogens like COVID, malaria, HIV, anthrax are based on strategies that could, according to evolutionary models and lab experiments, encourage pathogens to become even more dangerous. Think about this. A vaccine is developed through experimentation in labs. Do you realize that the experimentation is ongoing outside those labs? Mental or external experimentation is occurring in living, breathing, sentient labs called the inoculated. From chickens to people, the inoculated are oblivious to timed experimentation happening inside their bodies and outside their bodies as they interact with the world around them. Oh, and one more thing. Notice that I do not use words such as immunized or immunization. Words like immunize and immunization are deliberately crafted to trick a mind into a false sense of security. Can you think of another thing which can cause the same effect? What about placebo and placebo effect? If you are imbued with an immune response function, aka so-called immune system, or as I like to call it accurately, immune grid, then how can a drug or a vaccine immunize you with immunity? Aren't you already immunized naturally? Immunization is a kind of like hairdresser giving someone a hair permanent, and for those who know about permanence, they weaken hair follicles and roots. I think the main ingredient in most commercial perms is lye. So I guess it would be astute of me to say a perm is a lie, just as an immunization is a lie. Okay, enough wordplay. Finally, I wonder if those scientists in the Merrick's disease study ever considered changing the conditions and practices of the poultry industry. The poultry industry and its inhumane, unhealthy practices are breeding grounds for disease. If these animals were placed in natural settings and allowed to eat what nature intended for them to eat, not to mention never fed hormones and antibiotics, their natural biological functions to fight off disease would kick in, and the so-called Merrick's disease would eventually eradicate itself. Just a thought. Almost 14 days before this recording, and I'm recording this June 14th, 2021, allegedly, a client and I participated in a virtual one-to-one. The client admitted before we began the appointment that they were unaware of the Q&A format and thus unprepared to ask questions. Nevertheless, the one-to-one flowed smoothly for time allotted, with questions revolving around specific personal points that the client volunteered. When session was over, I still sensed something was incomplete, especially with how the client expressed themselves. I also sensed that there were influences stifling their words. Less than 48 hours later, the client responded to a post-session survey that I customarily send out or email to all my clients. This client indicated on the survey that they had different expectations about how our one-to-one was supposed to go. Basically, the client had issues with the Q&A format. The client expected me to give a lecture. They based this on a particular service description shown on the Select Service page of my website. You should visit my site and read the description shown under the images for each service I offer so you get an idea or a visual for what I speak. But what I admire so much about this particular client was that they not only filled out the survey, but also offered candid, constructive criticism for me. It is so important that we do this for one another and with one another, being honest, courteous, and unafraid of speaking what matters most to us or to an overall situation. Being mature and patient enough to give and or receive honest constructive criticism is but one of the ways we optimize public speaking skills, negotiation abilities, while achieving critical thinking and successful communicating. Based on this critique, I decided to give a lecture on overcoming communication obstacles and keeping communications easy and clear. As I stated, I utilize Q&A or question and answer often when communicating with learners, clients, and students. I encourage questions through specific wording and pausing after three or four sentences in a row. I often say, "Okay, your turn," or "It's your turn to share," or "I'd like to hear your ideas." Obviously, in a pre-recorded podisode, it's not actually interactive, where listeners can respond to questions, so I offer challenges or rhetorical questions which encourage listeners to wonder or think about what I said. I'll often follow up explanations through elaboration so that nothing is left to guessing or misunderstanding. Thanks to my client who offered feedback and analysis, this is truly how positive communicating is supposed to work. Our words are meant to perform many functions, such as inform, repair, resolve, correct, and assist. I support and promote a no fear of words approach, especially when getting down to the facts or core perspectives of any topic. Being able to confidently, calmly, and clearly express oneself does not come easily for everyone, however. So I recommend always being patient, even when you do not receive the same energy. As a counselor teacher, one of my responsibilities is helping listeners or learners to feel at ease and experience a sense of confidence before they speak or ask questions. You can say that my method epitomizes true bedside manner, figuratively speaking. My email for responses to this lecture segment is know or no at pharaohshouse.com. That's no at pharaohshouse.com. Replay this segment if you'd like. And remember, you can always ask me questions. Pharaoh's House Podisode is the sole property of pharaohshouse.com. All third-party copyrights revert to their original owners. To inquire about syndication or sponsorship, please visit our website at pharaohshouse.com. Did you know you're missing out? To hear this podisode in its entirety, become a paying subscriber. For just $2.25 a month, you can access all of my podisode lectures without interruption and know that you're supporting a great cause. Just go to pharaohshouse.com and click subscribe on the top menu bar. That's pharoshouse.com. And thank you in advance.